It's Tuesday, September 9th, 2008, and it's 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Hey everybody, welcome to the Daily Audio Stash. Sorry about missing you on Monday. I had, quite the day. If you've been reading the Stash blog at stash.normal.org, you'll know what happened. I went out to walk my dog, seriously, walking my dog, and on my way back home, I tripped on the sidewalk. Yes, I tripped on the sidewalk, messed up my toe pretty bad, got a sprained big toe, had to go to the doc in the box. I took kind of a header too, kind of hit my shoulder and so on, so wasn't the best of days for me. Oh, and before you ask, no, I wasn't high at the time. Maybe that was the problem. Anyway, coming back here for your Daily Audio Stash, today is our Government at Work Day, so I'm going to be replaying my interview with Representative Barney Frank regarding H.R. 5843, the bill to end federal penalties for adult marijuana possession. Make sure you get yourself registered to vote and let your elected officials know how you feel about the marijuana issue. Then, following our musical break, we'll be playing some of the audio from the Portland Hemp Stock that took place this weekend. There was a great hemposium that we put on where we had panels of experts answering questions from the community, and this particular hemposium was on industrial hemp. So you'll be hearing Paul Stanford from the Campaign for Restoration and Regulation of Hemp, and Scott Gordon from HerbAge Designs, which is a hemp products retailer, as well as other experts discussing the nature of industrial hemp and how we can get it re-legalized in this country. All right, everybody, it's been a long three-day weekend, so to speak, so let's twist up a fatty and enjoy your normal daily audio stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Freedom fighter Eddie Lepp found guilty by feds. From the Santa Rosa Press-Democrat. Eddie Lepp, age 56, was convicted Tuesday by a U.S. District Court jury of conspiracy to possess marijuana with the intent to distribute more than 1,000 marijuana plants and of cultivating more than 1,000 marijuana plants, the U.S. Attorney's Office said. He faces between 10 years and life in prison and a maximum fine of $4 million when he's sentenced on December 1st, said U.S. Attorney's Office spokesman Joshua Eaton. Lepp, who said he is Rastafarian as well as a minister of the Universal Life Church, claimed the marijuana was grown for spiritual and religious reasons. But Judge Patel said the number of plants being grown created too great a risk that some of them were being diverted for non-religious uses, he said. When federal and Lake County sheriff's officials raided the garden in 2004, they estimated there were more than 32,000 plants of varying sizes growing in neatly tilled rows near Highway 20 next door to a commercial strawberry patch. Lepp and High Times Magazine, a publication focused on marijuana production and laws, said it was the largest single crop of medical pot seized in the United States. The subsequent legal battle earned Lepe High Times 2004 Freedom Fighter of the Year Award. Lep said Thursday and at trial that the plants weren't his. The marijuana was being grown cooperatively by members of his church, said Lep, the founder of Eddie's Medicinal Gardens. Lep said, quote, "All I did was make the land available to the ministry," end quote. Eddie appeared at our Portland hemp stock this weekend and gave a very moving speech in which he intoned somberly that it may be the last hemp festival he's ever able to attend. I've got the video and I'll have that online later this week. There's really something wrong with the world when a kind gentleman like Eddie Lep, who only helped people who knowingly wished to consume cannabis, gets 10 or more years. But the guy who cooked Enron's books, the company that defrauded thousands of employees of their 401k retirement plans, that fleeced the state of California with fraudulent energy speculation, that is responsible for the rolling blackouts that endangered people's lives and property, that guy, Andrew Fastow, only got a 6-year sentence. There's really something unjust about our society when a sincerely devout man like Eddie Lep, who alleviated the suffering of so many California medical marijuana patients, is guaranteed to serve at least 10 years, but the prophet of the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who used his religious influence to pander 14-year-old and younger girls for polygamist marriage to their first cousins over 3 decades, that guy, Warren Jeffs, he may be eligible for parole before serving his full 10-year sentence. Santa Cruz City Council could lift smoking ban for WhamFest, from the San Jose Mercury News. The smoking ban in city parks could be lifted for the second time since it passed 3 years ago, as city leaders are considering allowing medical marijuana patients to light up during a festival at San Lorenzo Park at the end of the month. Councilman Mike Rotkin, who supports the temporary lifting of the city's 3-year-old ordinance that bans smoking in parks, said, quote, "It's not like a recreational marijuana event. It's not a smoke-in. It's not like the 420 thing up on campus," end quote. That April 20th event attracts thousands of people to Porter Meadow at UC Santa Cruz each spring to celebrate the so-called 420 cannabis culture holiday. Instead, the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana would like the ban lifted so its 200 members can self-medicate while they enjoy the organization's annual festival. WhamFest, a medical marijuana, hemp, and music festival, is scheduled for September 27th. Valerie Corral, the co-founder of Wham, said, quote, "As patients, it's really important to have access to the medicine in the most discreet and reasonable fashion," end quote. The item will be considered on the City Council's consent agenda today. The Council unanimously approved a similar temporary suspension of the smoking ban for last year's event. A closed tent will be available at the festival for those who need to administer their prescription drugs, and no pot will be for sale or distributed, Rotkin said. Santa Cruz police reported no problems with last year's festival, but after Measure K was passed with 60% of the vote in 2006, Santa Cruz police are forced to make adult marijuana-related crimes on private property a low priority. Remember when people were allowed to smoke cigarettes in airplanes and elevators? Now you can't smoke a cigarette in a public park, but you can smoke marijuana. What a country! Well, seriously, though, this is a wonderful victory for Valerie and the movement. Police will always tell you our cannabis community events are, by far, the most peaceful scenes they have to patrol. A reporter asked police at the Seattle Hemp Fest, with its 150,000 people, how it compared to patrolling a Seahawks or a Mariners game where beer is served. And the police said Hemp Fest was, quote, "a Girl Scout camp," compared to policing half the number of beer drinkers. And while I support perfectly healthy people smoking weed in the park, there is no doubt that many patients would have no possible way to enjoy a nice sunny day in nature without being able to medicate. Life is tough enough when you have a debilitating injury or illness. Letting them smoke cannabis in the park is the compassionate thing to do. Normal's Dominic Holden on Senator Biden as Vice President. From The Stranger. As former chairman for the Senate Judiciary Committee, Biden is the person most responsible for passing a package of laws in the mid-80s that we think of as today's drug war. Biden presided over the mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines that required judges to sentence dealers' girlfriends and small-time peddlers to decades-long terms in state and federal prisons, where thousands are rotting to this day. He used hearings, quote, to mislead his colleagues and the public on drug policy, where police and prosecutors and DEA officials got the opportunity to speak while opponents were kept out, end quote, says Kevin Zeese, a former director of Common Sense for Drug Policy and a leading drug law reformer in Washington, D.C. since the 1980s. Quote, pick a drug law you don't like from the last 25 years and thank Senator Biden, end quote. It wasn't just coincidence that these laws were passed while Biden was at the helm of the Judiciary Committee. He was the leading advocate for establishing the Office of National Drug Control Policy, the White House Drug Czar's office, an agency that to this day gives lip service to drug treatment programs but spends its millions on ads linking pot to terrorism. The ads actually increase drug initiation rates among teenagers. He's a conservative on most crime issues. And in recent years, Biden pushed the so-called RAVE Act, which criminalized everyone attending parties where drugs were found. Biden is the drug war embodied. But, since this is Obama's campaign, I'm trying to hope that Biden can change. Quote, our intentions were good, but much of our information was bad, end quote, said Biden in February. He decried the very sentencing disparities he created between crack and cocaine, which is one of the reasons prisons are full of young black men. Quote, each of the myths upon which we base the sentencing disparity has since been dispelled or altered, end quote, he said. A change of heart, perhaps. Obama cannot alter drug laws on his own. He's lived a youth of indiscretions. Realistically, no politician can make any sweeping changes. It must be incremental. But if anyone has the credibility at the federal level to say we were wrong, to push the Senate for sentencing reform, to back Barney Frank's bill in the House to decriminalize pot, nobody is more capable than Joe Biden. And if he does, this could be an excellent 4 years. As one commenter at the slog noted, with Obama-Biden, we may have a shot in hell at getting some positive drug law reform. With McCain-Palin, we have no shot in hell. And while the Greens and Libertarians are much better on the drug issue, they've got a snowball's chance in hell of getting elected. My personal recommendation? Not a normal official stance? When asked how a drug law reformer should vote, is to first figure out whether your state is safe. If it is a lock for either McCain, like, say, Utah, or Obama, like, say, California, then vote the issue and throw some love to the Greens or the Libs. The more votes they get, the more their platform has to be recognized by the Dems. But if you're in a battleground state, I believe personally that you've got to put your hope on Obama and cross your fingers with Biden. John McCain literally has turned his back on wheelchair-bound medical marijuana patients and said he doesn't believe in medical marijuana. Dispute grows over medical marijuana plants. From KPTV, Portland, Oregon. Vancouver, Washington. Vancouver residents expressed concern Monday about marijuana growing in their neighbor's yard. A woman growing the pot said she's a cancer patient and she has a medical marijuana card allowing her to grow some for personal use. But one neighbor said he thinks she is growing more than she needs, and he wants law enforcement officers to do something about it. There are some marijuana plants growing behind one home, and a neighbor said he doesn't think the plants are following medical marijuana guidelines. Neighbor Jack Lennon said, quote, I don't smoke pot, and I know people that do, and I know that that's a lot more than 60 days. Those are the biggest plants I've ever seen. I think if it's going to be grown, it needs to be regulated. It needs to be supervised, end quote. The woman who was growing the marijuana said that she's never done anything illegal in her life. She said she was going to get chemotherapy Monday and that the plants are part of her treatment. Jack Lennon of Vancouver, Washington, you are the winner of today's Lousy Neighbor Award. No, I take it back. How about Lousy Human Being? Your neighbor is a cancer patient who has followed the law of the state of Washington. It is not her fault that the law has such a vague standard of 60-day supply. Indeed, how much is a valid 60-day supply of marijuana for someone who is battling death, losing hair, vomiting, poisoning their body with radiation, weakening, lowering their immune system, plagued by nausea? What, you think 3 ounces is good? The governor of Washington State asked the experts, people not like Jack Lennon of Vancouver, Washington, people who have actually grown marijuana plants and understand that plant yields vary, that molds, mites, fungus, and various other problems can attack a garden, people who actually work with patients and understand that some may eat their medicine and thus require 4 times more of it than a smoker or a vaporizer. And those experts, unlike Jack Lennon of Vancouver, Washington, recommended that Washington State allow 70 ounces, that's 4 3/8 pounds, as a 60-day supply. Now that freaked out law enforcement, so now the compromise limit suggested is 24 ounces, a pound and a half, which matches the limit across the river in Portland, Oregon. But let's suppose for a moment that Jack Lennon of Vancouver, Washington has a point. Maybe she does have a honkin' huge cannabis sativa plant in her backyard, and it's more than she could use in 60 days. So what? She might have enough to last 75 days? 90 days? A year? Good! A cancer patient has more than enough medicine. Hooray! That's something to be happy about, not something you run to the cops about rather than just having a face-to-face talk with your cancer-stricken neighbor, Jack Lennon of Vancouver, Washington. Maybe she even has so much medicine that she freely gives some to other cancer patients, or she donates some to the many patient cooperatives that help people with AIDS, MS, chronic pain, intestinal disorders, seizures, asthma, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress, and so much more. It is regulated. It is supervised. You are already forcing sick people to get a doctor's note to grow a non-toxic herb in their own homes. What more do you want, Jack Lennon of Vancouver, Washington? Regular visits from some state garden inspector? Home supervision by a trained medical professional to control the dosage of the weed? Video cameras in the yard and inside the home supervised by Blackwater contractors plugged in directly to Dick Cheney's secret bunker? Oh, and by the way, the Vancouver police do not believe that there is any illegal marijuana activity going on, Jack Lennon of Vancouver, Washington.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Tuesday is our look at your government at work here at the Audio Stash. While the inevitable re-legalization of cannabis hemp will have to happen at the federal level, the steps leading to that destination take place at the state and municipal levels. We focus in on the initiatives, bills, and amendments regarding cannabis across all 50 states and what activists like you are doing to enact a positive reform to our cruel and outdated marijuana laws.
Body dies,
working hard to make an impact in your city and state, please email us at stash@normal.org and let's share your local efforts with the worldwide cannabis community. Together, we can affect our government at work.
We have to do revolution, right?
rises high into the sky. How can we still deny the truth?
Congressman Barney Frank has represented Massachusetts' 4th District since 1981 and is a champion of civil rights on Capitol Hill. This Wednesday, he announced his bill to end federal penalties for the personal possession of marijuana, the first such legislation introduced in about 30 years. So thank you for joining us on the show, Representative Frank.
You're welcome. I'm glad to have a chance to continue to carry the word.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you've been a champion of this issue in one form or another. I know you've sponsored the state's rights to medical marijuana bill, which has had some trouble getting through the House. So what encouraged you to move forward now with full decriminalization, which is much more controversial?
Well, it is a position I, frankly, have been advocating for. Because I did this when I was in the state legislature in Massachusetts in 1973 and 74. I thought now it was time to be able to do it. Look, I've always felt this, but you don't want to raise an issue, at least I don't want to raise an issue, if I think the overwhelming reaction is going to be negative, because people can kind of get locked in a negative way. I have felt for some time now that the public is clearly ahead of the politicians on this one. That's not always the case. There are issues where I think the public sometimes doesn't see through some propaganda. But it did occur to me that the public, and particularly young people, were ahead. It's also, frankly, probably because we have the Internet now. You know, this is not an issue that the newspapers and networks are going to give a lot of attention to. But the Internet exists as a way to communicate with people who care about this. And I particularly, frankly, I've been pleased to see that a lot of younger people have gotten, it seems, more interested in politics these days, probably because Senator Obama appeals to them, also because of the environmental issue. And, you know, that's an obvious one. When I speak to student audiences, I say, you know, look, in terms of global warming, you know, by the time it really gets bad, I'll be dead. So I would assume you guys would be the ones who'd want to deal with it. So it did seem to me this is a good time to begin this discussion, because I think the public is ready to educate my colleagues, and because you got a lot of young people who will join in.
Now, you're close to the end of the session, so it's likely that this bill would be heard and debated in the next Congress. Do you feel that there's going to be a significant difference in the opinion of the upcoming Congress on this issue?
There will be. Look, I don't think we're going to be able to get it passed in the next Congress or two. I am optimistic we'll ultimately be doing this. What you really need to do is begin the conversation. I need my colleagues to be hearing from people. That's why I'm really glad that you know, we're able to do this, and I've done some other radio interviews. A number of my colleagues already, because there's been some publicity on it, came to me and said, hey, I was in my district and, you know, somebody said, but I signed on to your bill, tell me about it. So what we need, this is one where the public's going to have to give the lead to the members of Congress, but I think that can happen.
Now, this debate is one that's kind of different than a lot of other debates on Capitol Hill, because you're going to get significant pushback on this from the executive branch in the form of the ONDCP, which is mandated by law to oppose any sort of measures that might decriminalize or legislate cannabis.
I think that will diminish when we are rid of the Bush administration and its extreme right-wing operation. I must say it is interesting at a time when the administration tells us they can't afford to put money into cleaning up Superfund sites or helping us with public transportation or providing adequate health care even to veterans who are coming back from Iraq, that they can spend all this money on an office that's been very ineffective. And, you know, the idea that a paid employee of the federal government was out there handing out this propaganda, I have no objection to it in principle. I think people should be able to speak, but it is an example of the waste of time and effort.
Yeah, exactly. Now, there are 12 states in America now that regulate the use of medical marijuana, and California in particular has been victimized by DEA raids on those dispensaries. How would this bill affect
If this bill passed, either bill, because we have the medical marijuana bill, this is a border bill, it would say that at the very least, well, two ways. If this bill passed, the patients would no longer be subject to harassment. You would need the medical marijuana bill to protect the clinics as well. So I'd want to see both bills passed. But as you know, as you said, you know, I'll give credit to Janet Reno. When she was Attorney General, she did not do this. John Ashcroft became Attorney General in this right-wing administration and started prosecuting very sick people who were following California law to take marijuana. Really a despicable set of activity, it seems to me. Either bill would stop that with regard to the patients. You'd need both bills to be able to protect the clinics.
Okay. Now, just north of California in Oregon, there's some cannabis supporters there that are putting together a measure that would tax and regulate the sales of marijuana through liquor stores in the state. Would this bill help in that realm, or are we going to have to go farther?
It would allow them to, I take it back. You'd have to go beyond that because this bill is for personal use and nonprofit distribution and effect sharing. I agree with that proposal. I want to have the debate about the basic principle about whether or not the federal government should be regulating people's private lives. Now, ultimately, you would want to get to that, but I don't want it to be distorted into, you're going to have these massive distributions. I mean, the principle, by the way, and I want to address one argument, which I hope some of the people listening will also be able to use. One of the questions I get is, why are you encouraging the use of marijuana? And the answer is, I'm not. There's this notion that's really very antithetical to the kind of government we want to live in. It says that, human activity is divided into two categories. One, things that should be criminal. Two, things that the government is encouraging. And there are some things that I want to encourage. I do want to encourage energy conservation, and I think we should encourage people to exercise and, eat healthy in some ways. But on the whole, the view would be that what you choose to do on your leisure time is your own. And the fact that it isn't illegal doesn't mean I'm encouraging it. People do a lot of things in this society that I don't do, that if you ask my advice, I'd say, I don't know why you'd want to do that, but I shouldn't make them criminal. And that's what we're saying with smoking marijuana, this notion that if the government doesn't send you to jail for it, the government's telling you to do it, misunderstands the nature of a free government.
Good point. That's a black and white thinking there. Now, some critics might point out here that the bill, as it's written right now, allows the possession of up to 100 grams of marijuana, about 3.5 ounces. And some people might point out that that's an extreme amount. How did you come up with that amount?
Well, we tried to have a margin that people wouldn't be unduly harassed for. To be honest, the details at this point are less important than getting the principle out there.
Okay.
And, you don't want people who have a personal use stash to get caught up in this in a way. As I said, there's no exactitude here, and I would hope we could debate the principle. Obviously, we'd be flexible on the specifics when we got to it.
Okay. Another line of attack that I can envision here is people saying that by decriminalizing the possession without doing anything about the sales, all you do is create more of a market for the black market that already exists that causes all the harms of marijuana.
Well, we couldn't be doing that. Anybody with any sense of reality understands that there's a flourishing black market now, because one of the oddest defenses I get of the law is, don't repeal the law, it's not being enforced. And that's a terrible way to deal with the law. You don't want to tell police officers and others, look, we don't really care about this law, so we're going to keep it on the books, but we're going to tell you not to enforce it. I mean, the notion that there's any deterrent effect in the law right now, I think it's very small.
Okay. Now, you're in Massachusetts, up in the Northeast, and I'm calling you from Portland, Oregon, out in the West, and our areas of the country seem to be a lot more tolerant to marijuana use and its users. Why is there, in your opinion, such opposition in Washington and in some other places in the country to this notion?
Well, I think it's cultural lag. Look, people have seen drugs do bad things to people, but in particular, marijuana became identified first in the 30s and later in the 60s, with kind of countercultural activity. It was identified with musicians who engaged in interracial dating at a time in the 30s when the prejudices on race were so strong. In the 60s, it particularly became identified with people who were against the war. And I think that's why it's hard to understand in rational terms why you have this crusade on the books with people like the ONDCP against marijuana and not at all against alcohol. So I think it has to do with cultural things. But the other point I would make is this. The politicians today are people most of whose careers began 20, 30, and 40 years ago. I think the average voter today is much less obsessed with this. And indeed, as you look at the younger people, they think it's silly. So I think this is one where, particularly over the years coming forward, the politicians, as I said, are going to be educated by the public to lose their fear of doing the right thing.
Now, Congressman Frank, when you first announced this on the Bill Maher show, you had made the point that you've been in office for so long now that you really don't care what other people might think of you doing this. What do you think the political ramifications might be, though, for other?
Well, I did say I thought I could get away with it now, and I may have been misinterpreted. What I really meant was I think that we can have a public debate now where there'll be a lot of support for it. Personally, look, people, when I first ran for office, people used this against me because I'd advocated it in the state legislature, so it was used against me in campaigns of 1882. I genuinely believe that the average citizen understands that this is a silly law. As I said, I think the public's ahead of the politicians, so what I was trying to do was to get to my colleagues and say, look, don't be afraid of doing the right thing here.
Okay. Now, as far as the nuts and bolts of Congress, where does this bill head next? Has it made it to committee? Will it be assigned?
It will be assigned to committee because I'm dealing with criminal penalties. It'll go to the Judiciary Committee primarily. I don't expect anything to happen for the rest of this year, but I would hope that we could have some hearings on it next year. You know, look, as you have mentioned, we've had the state's rights to medical marijuana law. That started out with a few votes, a handful of votes. It's now getting 40% of the House up in the 170, 180 range. It's not there yet, but it's moving, and I think the same thing will happen here once we start talking about it.
Excellent. Well, Congressman Barney Frank is the chief sponsor of the H.R. 5843 bill, the bill to end federal penalties for the use of marijuana by responsible adults. And, sir, we thank you very much for joining us here on the show.
Thank you, and I'm glad that we had a chance to talk some more.
I'm Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of NORML. Have you heard about the new super pot that's supposedly 20 times more potent than your father's Woodstock weed? Don't believe the hype. Marijuana's THC potency has always varied, even in the 60s and 70s. And the drug czar's numbers are full of, well, exaggerations. While no intoxicant is harmless, cannabis is non-toxic and far safer than alcohol. No matter how much you smoke, of whatever potency, you cannot die of a marijuana overdose. Potency is irrelevant anyway. More potent pot just means you smoke less of it, meaning less harmful smoke in your lungs. This is a prime example of harm reduction in action. Besides, the government already allows the prescription of THC pills. Its commercial brand name is Marinol, and it's 100% potent. Meanwhile, the federal government won't allow dying people to use natural marijuana, no matter what the potency. Does this make sense to you? Learn the facts about pot. Visit NORML.org today.
Here at the NORML Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. Welcome to our musical break, Stashers. We've got a song left over from Blues Monday yesterday, so I want to get this out today. It's a kick-ass blues song by Nick Graventites and Michael Bloomfeld called Gypsy Good Time. And it is festival season. We just wrapped up the Portland Hemp Stock to end the Pacific Northwest festival season. And that's all about celebrating and having fun. Even though you may not be familiar with Nick Graventites, he has been an important behind-the-scenes blues player and has written many well-known and loved blues songs for artists like Janis Joplin, Paul Butterfield, Charlie Musselwhite, Otis Rush, David Crosby, and Quicksilver Messenger Service. He has performed on more than 45 albums as a singer, guitarist, songwriter, or bandleader. Graventites is the son of Greek immigrants and grew up on Chicago's South Side. He began playing guitar at the University of Chicago in 1956. He met Paul Butterfield and they began playing acoustic blues at campus coffeehouses. He started hanging out with musicians like Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and Charlie Musselwhite.
He moved to San Francisco and formed the short-lived but legendary band The Electric Flag with Bloomfield, and they made their first performance at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967. This is blues at its best. Gather a few of your favorite gypsy friends and have yourself a real good time. To learn more about this album, just visit our website at stash.normal.org, where we've got links to the album and to an MP3 download of this song. It's Nick Graventites and Michael Bloomfield with Gypsy Good Time.
Show you a gypsy good time. Follow me, baby. Show you a gypsy good time. Yes, I'm gonna deal out these cards, dear woman, and lay it all on the line. You've got a red queen in your love life, the black king right beside. Jack of diamonds can't help you, baby. He was born to ride, so follow me, baby. Show you a gypsy good time. Yes, I'm gonna deal out these cards, dear woman, and lay it all on the line. Well, they say this is a man's world, keeps the cards stacked. Come on and follow me, baby, deal your aces back to back. So follow me, baby. Show you a gypsy good time. Yes, I'm gonna deal out these cards, dear woman, and lay it all on the line. So follow me, baby. 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 Show you a gypsy good time. Yes, I'm gonna deal out these cards, dear woman, and lay it all.
Hey, how's it going? My name's Will. I don't work at a used record store. I don't own an iguana, although I'm sure they make great pets. I don't have dreadlocks or play the acoustic guitar. I can remember quite well, thank you, and no, I don't constantly have the munchies. When 420 comes around, I've still got 40 minutes of work left. I've never hit a girl on a bike with my car or shot my friend with a shotgun. I've never had to apologize for letting a girl I was watching drown in a pool while I was getting high because, duh, I wouldn't be getting high if I was around children. I'm a regular guy who works regular jobs, just like the majority of all Americans who use marijuana occasionally and responsibly. My name is Will, and I'm normal.
This last weekend was the Portland Hempstock, and we featured a hemposium where the cannabis community could ask questions of the experts in various fields related to cannabis. Our first hemposium panel was composed of experts on hemp, including Paul Stanford of the Campaign for the Restoration and Regulation of Hemp, and Scott Gordon from HerbAge Designs, a hemp clothing retailer. So here are some clips from the hemposium on industrial hemp.
Hemp has been grown in Europe for probably about 1,000 years, and the literature from that era says that it can grow up to as far as the Arctic Circle. Now, at the Arctic Circle, during the summertime, the sun shines about 18 hours a day or something like that, so it's been growing a long, long time. And remember, they grew it up in the Himalaya Mountains also.
That's its natural location, was the heights of the Himalaya Mountains. And if you go through Nepal and Kashmir and India, all the mountaintops are covered in hemp.
That would be Vermont.
There have been a lot of states that
New Hampshire is working
legislation,
hard.
North Dakota being one, but the DEA so far has stood in the way and said no. You know, each person's decided they didn't want to try to grow it without getting federal permission too. And I remember back in the early 90s, it used to be about $50 to apply for a license to get hemp from the DEA, to grow hemp. And they turned it down without a doubt. Then it was about 94, they increased the fee because they're getting so many requests. They increased the fee from $500 to like $1,500. And now they still get them on occasion and turn down those applications. I know a Republican legislature in North Dakota, where they passed hemp legislation, David Monson attempted to get that license, and the DEA hasn't ever issued one for commercial production.
And as a result of that lawsuit he was talking about, the judge came back and said, you know, you guys have a case, but the only person, the only group that can change this is Congress, just based on how the laws are written. And North Dakota went back after hearing this from the judge, and they changed the law saying, you know what, forget the federal government. You can get your tax permission, your permit, directly from the state government. Now, how that all plays out in the courts and, you know, drug eradication efforts and all that other stuff remain to be seen, but the people of North Dakota are facing the same thing farmers across this country are, which is why I think it's really important that we look toward doing federal action and getting big sweeping legislative changes.
Well, for farmers, it would revolutionize agriculture, because instead of buying petrochemicals and buying fuel for their tractors, they could press their own fuel. And the byproduct is going to be food. You know, what I often quote, and there's some dispute in the hemp industry about this, is a study from Notre Dame University. It was published in a magazine called The Midlands Naturalist in 1975. And it's called Barrel Hemp in Southern Illinois. And that article examined plants that had a THC level of 3 to 5%, which isn't that high, but it's kind of your standard Mexican potency range. But in that article, they said that an acre of hemp produces 4 tons, 8,000 pounds of hemp seed. So if you look at the low THC hemp strains that are currently available for cultivation, They're available in Canada and Europe. And they're all a patented strain of hemp that comes from France and a company in France that it naturally varies. So you can't grow your own seed. You have to keep going back to the patented seed company and getting this controlled hemp seed that will produce under a half of 1% THC, but the plant naturally wants to produce more. What they've done is they have an unstable hybrid, and they sell the unstable hybrid, and they've bred it to breed out the flowers. And by breeding out the flowers, they breed out the dangerous THC, or tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the thing that gives us a psychoactive response. And it's good for nausea, as an appetite stimulant, and for depression, anxiety, things like that. But by breeding out the THC, they breed out the flowers. And by breeding out the flowers, they breed out the seeds. By breeding out the seeds, they breed out the oil and protein from the plant, which is one of its most valuable products. So this study from Notre Dame looks at wild hemp from here in the United States. And the United States was one of the best hemp-producing regions in the Kentucky area throughout the Mississippi and Ohio River valleys. And they can't really wipe it out. They've been trying for ages to wipe it out. It even grows in the state capital lands in St. Paul, Minnesota. They can't wipe that out. But you can get pictures with the marijuana plants, the hemp plants, with the state capital behind it, with, you know, at the head of the Mississippi River. But anyway, so the hemp industry, by and large, it can't use these strains of hemp. They're limited to these low THC strains. The low THC strains average 600 pounds of seed per acre. And so the people in the hemp industry and a lot of the hemp organizations, they only advocate the use of hemp less than a half of 1%. And by advocating that, all the other hemp that is more productive is out of the picture. And what it is, that low THC hemp produces about 40% of the fiber and about 5% of the seed. You know, the difference is 8,000 pounds compared to 600 pounds. And so, obviously, if you're only getting 600 pounds of seeds per acre, that's a huge difference from 8,000 pounds. But the people in the hemp industry kind of look at Okta and our claims based on this study as, well, you're not actually telling the farmers the truth. This is what one hemp organization contacted us, because they think we're advocating what they're advocating, which is the cultivation of low THC hemp. And that's not what we're advocating. We're advocating the cultivation of hemp that is the most productive for fiber, protein, and oil. And so by doing that, you know, I don't know if any of you have ever seen the difference between little teeny tiny sativa seeds and real big fat indica seeds. But indica seeds are a lot bigger, meatier, and less hull or shell coating on the outside. And so it's going to produce even more than the feral hemp in southern Illinois. And the other thing you got to consider is hemp's been out of the picture for the past 80, 90 years, since 1900, in terms of developing the plant. And we have petroleum engineers who don't do anything in their life but study how to convert petroleum molecules into 50,000 different products. Just imagine if we had 100 years of science where those petroleum engineers were working on biodiesel or vegetable oil or the most productive oil crop. We'd have a lot more sustainable development. That's going to be the kind of things that the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act, when it passes, will open the market to. Scott, would you like to reiterate? Now we have a larger crowd here.
Scott Gordon, I'm Scott Gordon. I'm Herbage Designs, and we're a gift and apparel company, and we sell hemp gear also. We've been going a good 6 years now. We frequent the hemp fests, and we're on herbagedesigns.com, so we do a lot of education and selling our gear too. But we also feel hemp is very important and from a business standpoint, we think it's important to mainstream it and get it into some mainstream products, such as purses and tote bags and socks. All this stuff is good stuff. It's really better than what's on the market now, and if we can just do as David said and, you know, get some hemp going, get it legalized where we can grow it here in our own country, manufacture it in our own country, and make our own products, it sure would go a long ways. And mainstreaming it means that we all have to support the product. You know, when you go into stores and you have a hemp product there next to another product, and maybe it's cool to pay a couple extra bucks and pay for that hemp product because that store is going to order that product again. And there's a lot of stores out there who are right there on the borderline now. They're wanting to bring in hemp. They're a little bit concerned. They're scared. But if they knew that we would purchase and buy and support this product, they would also do the same thing. So from a business standpoint, we think it's important to support it, definitely.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another one of our cannabis quotes, this one recognizing the 20-year anniversary this last Saturday of a ruling by the Drug Enforcement Administration's own Chief Administrative Law Judge, Francis Young, during a case that sought to move marijuana from Schedule 1 to a lower drug schedule so that it could be prescribed medically. Judge Young said, quote, "Marijuana in its natural form is one of the safest therapeutically active substances known to man. By any measure of rational analysis, marijuana can be safely used within a supervised routine of medical care. The evidence in this record clearly shows that marijuana has been accepted as capable of relieving the distress of great numbers of very ill people, and doing so with safety under medical supervision. It would be unreasonable, arbitrary, and capricious for DEA to continue to stand between those sufferers and the benefits of this substance in light of the evidence in this record," end quote. How much more do you need? The DEA's own Chief Administrative Law Judge thinks marijuana has medical purposes. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us here at the podcast. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.